So yes, it's page 384 and paragraph beginning, our unity with the world being. So in this paragraph, in this chapter, Sri Aurobindo is talking about the individual. And so far, what he has done is foregrounded the individual from the viewpoint of our ultimate goal, given the fact that there is a reality which is indivisible, which seems to be experienced by us in this form. I think again someone has got the mic on. Oh, okay. So, just a moment. So we find that Sri Aurobindo asked the question about individuality and says that if there is something which is indivisible and the only thing there is, then where is the place of the individual? Our experience of individuality is the experience of the ego, and this is a finite sense of being, or finite sense of being an individual, which necessarily experiences itself in terms of a separation. It's in relation to others and it is separate from others. So it would seem that if we are talking about realizing an indivisible being, this particular entity that is individualized and separate from others is not true, something which is to be removed, which needs to be removed. So we find that particular way of approaching the individual is something Sri Aurobindo takes up, because this has been one of the big problems of a spiritual seeking, which is if we are going to find something which is absolute, what is the reality of the relative? It has no reality and we have to erase it. And this is what most of the schools have posited. Sri Aurobindo takes a different standpoint, and he's talking about the fact that this indivisible being is nevertheless perceiving itself in such a way that it becomes a cosmos. And the cosmos, which is really a configuration or arrangement of the infinite possibilities of this indivisible being, posited both in terms of a dynamic relational space as well as a temporal unfolding. This is the cosmos. This is how the cosmos is configured. And it has in it entities that are individuals. So these are, as he will point out, on the multiplicity side of that indivisible being. If there is an indivisible being, it is one. And yet, that one is not one as we understand one, because as soon as we say one, mediated by our experience of the finite, we immediately mean one among many. While if there is only one without any other, then it falls into a category that is not of our finite experience. And therefore, there is a problem with this, a problem with our experience of this. So if we look at it from that point of view, we see that the one is also the infinite. It is multiplicity and unity that are coexistent in this one that alone is. So if we are to think of a multiplicity, which is the you know, the dynamic possibilities of the one, a radical infinity is the dynamic possibilities of the one, then we find that this many or this multiplicity manifests itself in two forms. One is what we can call the cosmos. The cosmos is a dynamic unfolding of the infinity of being. And the other is entity or individual. Each individual is one out of the infinite possibilities of being. So these two dimensions of the multiplicity constitute the cosmic existence. So it's the cosmos and the individual. As Sri Aurobindo is pointing out over here, these need not be contradictory with the only thing there is, the absolute. It is the absolute that has self-experienced itself, both as cosmos as the entities that inhabit that relational space called cosmos. So that's where he has brought us over here. And at this point, he's talking about how, in the previous paragraph, he has brought in the idea of the Purusha, which he introduced in the last chapter.
Hello? Is anyone there?
Hello? 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 Can somebody hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you there, Vasishtha.
Yeah. Someone was having trouble listening.
Joanna, who I just added to the call, so probably...
Okay. So, in that previous paragraph, he starts by saying, our unity with the world being is the consciousness of a self, which at one and the same time cosmicizes in the world and individualizes through the individual Purusha. Well, that's actually the paragraph we are about to begin. I think it was read last time. So, he reintroduces the idea of the Purusha, which was what the previous chapter was all about. So I think let's move on into the reading, or if anybody wishes to comment or question regarding what's gone on so far, you're welcome to do so.
Who did you ask to read?
Owen? If you're not ready, then somebody else.
Who did you ask to read?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, you, Owen. He asked you to read.
Oh, sorry about that. Yes, absolutely. It starts with our unity with the world being. Is that correct?
Yes, it does.
Okay, yes, I went back to review. Thank you. Our unity with the world being is the consciousness of a self which at one and the same time cosmicizes in the world and individualizes through the individual Purusha. And both in that world being and in this individual being and in all individual beings, it is aware of the same self manifesting and experiencing its various manifestations. That then is a self which must be one in its being, otherwise we could not have this experience of unity, and yet must be capable in its very unity of cosmic differentiation and multiple individuality. The unity is its being. Yes, but the cosmic differentiation and the multiple individuality are the power of its being, which it is constantly displaying, and which it is its delight and the nature of its consciousness to display. If then we arrive at unity with that, if we even become entirely and in every way that being, why should the power of its being be excised, and why at all should we desire or labor to excise it? We should then only diminish the scope of our unity with it by an exclusive concentration accepting the divine being, but not accepting our part in the power and consciousness and infinite delight of the divine. It would in fact be the individual seeking peace and rest of union in a motionless identity, but rejecting delight and various joy of union in the nature and act and power of the divine existence. That is possible, but there is no necessity to uphold it as the ultimate aim of our being or as our ultimate perfection.
So this is how he presents it in the sense of both the cosmos and the individuals in the cosmos are self-manifestations of a single self. And what it is doing here is, as he says, cosmicizing in the world and individualizing in each entity through an individual Purusha. So essentially what is happening is a manifestation, and these are the two terms of the manifestation. Elsewhere, Sri Aurobindo has spoken about two sacrifices, the sacrifice of Prakriti and the sacrifice of Purusha. The sacrifice of Prakriti is the involution of all the possibilities of being, making up the cosmos. So that is the bedrock or the matrix or the womb of the cosmos. This is the reason why it is the immanence of the divine within a cosmic configuration that will unfold its possibilities, its infinite possibilities. And the sacrifice of the Purusha is the self-involution of the divine, of the same self, in each entity within that cosmos. So there are, as it were, these two kinds of self-manifestations going on. One, the self-manifestation of the cosmos, or as the cosmos, which is arising from the self of the sacrifice of the Prakriti, forming the ground of cosmic existence and evolution. And on the other hand, you have the sacrifice of Purusha that enters into every entity within this cosmos and seeds the process of individualization. So what is individualization? What does he mean by cosmicizes in the world and individualizes in each through the individual Purusha? So these are the two terms. And the way we can see it is that both these configurations, the configuration of cosmos and the configuration of individual, is posited as a relational space, in as its spatial dimension, and as an unfolding as its temporal dimension. So this temporal dimension is one in which we find that these two sacrifices, sacrifice of Prakriti and sacrifice of Purusha, are both undertaken in such a way that there is the loss of the sense of divine self, which is self-becoming or self-experiencing in both these processes. It is, to use the terms of the philosopher Heidegger, the oblivion of being. It is the oblivion of being, the plunge into the abyssum. So we find that due to that oblivion, that is basically the sacrifice. The sacrifice is the positing of a time zero and a space zero, you know, a zero condition from which by absence there might be a gradual self-possession. Yet, as he's going to point out, this self-possession is not the same as losing something and regaining the same thing. It is a new gain, as it were. And that's something that we'll see, Sri Aurobindo points out. But at the same time, what we can find is that due to this self-oblivion, both in cosmos as well as in individual, there are two kinds of evolution going on. This is the cosmicizing of the world. The world is becoming more and more self-conscious of itself as cosmos, and the individualizing of each entity in the cosmos. This individualization is something in which we may say that the entire cosmos is trying to become self-conscious in every individual. This is the process of individualization that is going on. But that individual, as he says, it is occurring through the individual Purusha. As something which is occurring through the individual Purusha, it requires an adequate Prakriti through which it may experience its cosmic reality, its cosmic identity, that it is the cosmos. That Prakriti is part of the evolution of the cosmos. So cosmos is evolving, it's cosmicizing, the world is cosmicizing itself, and in this evolution, it is evolving new properties of Prakriti, which are enabling individuals to individualize. And yet, that individualization remains incomplete, remains incapable of experiencing the cosmos, of cosmicizing itself, until the adequate instruments of Prakriti are available. This is where the whole notion that is carried in certain other schools as well, particularly, say, for example, in the Bible, where it is said that, you know, in the Old Testament, it is said that man is made in the image of God. This notion of being made in the image of God is to say that it is only when an adequate instrument, prakritic instrument, is present that this individualization process can reach a point where that which is absolute can know itself to be relative. It can recognize or realize the fact that the cosmos dwells in the individual, and that the transcendent has become both the cosmos and the individual for the delight of the play of its own infinite possibilities. So this is the reason why Sri Aurobindo here will say that though from the viewpoint of being, there needs to be no creation. Being itself is just self-satisfied in its own infinite self-existence. But from the viewpoint of consciousness and delight, which are intrinsic properties of being, the infinity of being becomes the self-display and the self-play of being. This is why he's saying over there, the unity is its being, yes, but the cosmic differentiation and the multiple individuality are the power of its being, which it is constantly displaying, and which it is its delight and the nature of its consciousness to display. See, this is partly the reason why this connects to a saying by Nietzsche, where he says, talks about the eternal recurrence of the same, but in a kind of a explanatory way, he says, which is actually the eternal recurrence of difference. It is the eternal recurrence of the same, because it is the same that is never same. It is the same that is always the same and yet never the same. Its infinite potentiality is constantly in display. It is mobilizing its infinite potentiality. And It is the play of that potentiality which is the play of delight. So we see that Chit and Ananda are at play. Chit in manifesting its infinite possibilities, and Ananda in individualizing the play of infinite possibilities. This is what we find happening, and that's why Sri Aurobindo rounds up that paragraph by saying, it is possible to go back to the absolute and completely deny or excise individuality and cosmos. But that is something which is foolish in a way, because it misses the point. And as he's saying over here, it would in fact be the individual seeking peace and rest of union in a motionless identity, but rejecting delight and various joy of union in the nature and act and power of the divine existence. That is possible. In other words, rejecting the difference and moving into the peace is possible, but there is no necessity to uphold it as the ultimate aim of our being or as our ultimate perfection. There is no necessity to uphold it as our ultimate goal or ultimate perfection, because indeed the creation of adequate prakritis that will ultimately allow us to experience the totality of the absolute in the relative is the very gist of the evolution.
So what it sounds to me like, that paragraph, is describing, you know, the play of delight as kind of as practice, what we think of as practice, to learn, for learning.
Yeah, absolutely. You're quite right. In fact, there is a place in the synthesis where he'll say the experience of unity and the practice of unity, the experience of oneness and the practice of oneness in difference is the whole of the yoga.
Can you say that one more time, please?
The experience of oneness and the practice of oneness in difference. In difference is the whole of the yoga. That indeed is the play of the delight.
Devashish?
Yeah, Owen.
Kind of an interesting side note here in my studies and in my clinical practicum work. There's a lot of focus on difference and multiculturalism. And I just thought that, being able to, this is kind of a another view of being able to look at that and to be able to recognize that oneness in its many delightful, many different manifestations.
Exactly, exactly. As he's pointing out, and the way in which he points it out, as he says, it says the power of its being, which it is constantly displaying, and which it is its delight, and the nature of its consciousness to display. So, indeed, we are interacting with the self-delight of being in its difference, that it is so diverse, that it never repeats itself, that in a way it manifests infinite variations, is the very nature of the delight of being. And on the other hand, we find that it is one. And so, here is where, as you're saying, the whole issue of finding the root of oneness in the difference comes in. And it's not easy. And that's the kind of point where he's saying that from a certain point of view, it is evolutionary. Say, every entity is individualizing because the individualization process of the self that has become the individual and the cosmos is going on everywhere. Every tree, every animal is individualizing. Every bacterium is individualizing. But it can individualize only up to a certain point. In its essence, it is one with everything. But in its experience and in its ability to manifest that experience, it's limited by its prakriti. Because the Purusha can only experience as much of itself in the cosmos as its prakriti will allow it. And therefore, it is not so easy to just posit the fact that there is difference and that we can find the root of oneness in the difference. It requires the building the right prakritic substructures that will enable that possibility. And it requires the intrinsic experience of the one.
Does Sri Aurobindo, where would you say that Sri Aurobindo really goes into how the chela or the devotee can prepare those vessels? I mean, are we going to get into that in this later in the text, do you think? Or is it just that, I guess that's the foundation of the whole yoga, is how to prepare the vessel, prepare the prakriti to be more receptive.
Exactly. That is the very drift of the yoga. And as far as the life divine is concerned,
thank you. That was my next.
I think Michael, have you got your mic on? If you can turn it off. Yes. And as far as the life divine is concerned, the life divine is really preparing an orientation for us. This is the power of knowledge. The power of knowledge is to orient our progress and our existential direction. In understanding these things, they're like a compass. They orient us. And at the same time, our practices can arise out of that orientation. So that's where, when you say that, does he get into how to prepare the vessel, he does give a variety of pointers in this book, as well as in even more in the Synthesis of Yoga. But at the same time, what is really important is to orient oneself with the proper understanding, because if that isn't there, then it becomes only method. But if that is there, then the method arises in every individual as part of their individualization process.
Yeah, so it seems to me mostly in that respect, the orientation respect, to be a real kind of in the tradition of jnana yoga.
Yeah, in that sense, absolutely. I mean, jnana yoga in the sense that unless the orientation is there, if you want to call it that, but essentially it is integral yoga, because all the other yogas are mobilized in this yoga. And yet the reason why we are talking about orientation is not so much as just a jnana yoga, is because, as he says, as soon as you try to put it down into a method, you've stereotyped it. While it's really about individualization, and individualization is unique for every individual. It's only when you want something, that's how he kind of talks about it in a place. First, you have to want something, then you'll get it. Unless you want it, you'll never get it. And if you don't know what to want, you'll never get it. So it's all about knowing what it is that you want. That's what orientation is all about. As soon as you orient yourself, it's your will that is actually going to call out to the divine, and the divine will give you the methods that will prepare the vessel.
Thank you, Devashish.
I have a question. First is that it seems that really we don't have any choice but to follow what we came, with the initial purpose, to evolve, in other words, because if we don't individualize and don't find unity, basically, and forget about the world, basically, we are not really evolving, right? And then, if that is the only way to go, that means that is Purusha's will, in other words. So, who or what really may want to, disobey that initial will and forget the word and, lose this play of difference? Who, what part can do that? I mean, because the reason why I'm interested in this is that I want to find the way to understand free will here. What is free will?
Yeah, sure. That's a very profound question. And as far as this, as he says in the beginning of the synthesis of yoga, all life is yoga. And he's basically saying there exactly what you said in a summary form. All life is yoga because indeed it's only the cosmicizing of the world and the individualizing of every individual that is going on. That's the evolution. Those are the two evolutions, the two sacrifices and the two evolutions that are going on. Now, yet, individualization is really the way by which, we have a certain amount of sense of choice in moving in a certain direction. And, it's like saying that the divine has given his freedom to entities, but not given his knowledge to entities. It's the divine has withheld his oneness, but has told you, you're free to do whatever you want. This is the whole problem of ignorance and individualization in ignorance. And yet, it's not a problem. That is the ground condition of evolution. That's the reason why it's an exploration from zero, a ground zero. A ground zero is a complete forgetting. And if there is a complete forgetting, then there may be a number of choices that may be taken, and yet they may not necessarily be the choice of individualization that is seeded into the cosmos. The process of individualization is proceeding through the will of the Purusha, yes, but the will of the Purusha is being mediated by all the various ignorances of the Prakriti. So whatever it is that, because say for example, in our present condition, we are so far away from realizing this fact that this is, or this could be the very meaning of the cosmos, of the evolution, that we can take it that it is a undesirable condition. It's suffering, just as the Buddha said, is the very root of our experience. And since that is the case, we have to find a way out of suffering. So this is the way of free will, where you have the freedom to choose through the amount of prakriti that has been developed. Again, it's a question of the adequacy of the prakriti. Wherever the prakriti is right now, you awaken to the fact that there is something more to be had, that this condition that we are experiencing is not adequate. Then the question arises, then what is adequate? To arrive at an answer to that, we have to explore many kinds of alternatives. And exploring those alternatives, unless we get a clear directive from the divine, is part of the evolution of difference. that also is part of that. This is exactly what's going on. Otherwise, we wouldn't even have had an evolution of species. We would have had some kind of brilliant intuition in the microbe that would have allowed it to realize this and lead a divine life in the microbe world. But it is exactly because of the forgetting that ignorance is seeded with the freedom of exploring alternatives. And each alternative takes us in a way in a different direction through which we come to the same point eventually. It multiplies complexity and it arrives at infinite integration or integrality.
So then the question comes that it's okay, the way it, I understood what you said is that it's kind of an ignorance. In other words, the Prakriti is not prepared enough or is not clear enough to receive that actual will of the Purusha, but is sort of distorting and, you know, making it find alternative, which is not exactly the initial will or purpose. So if that is the case, then basically what you are saying is that moksha, I mean moksha meaning the liberation without the accepting the difference, meaning basically dissolving itself into the unity, that kind of thing comes with an ignorance?
Yeah, it does come with an ignorance. It comes with the ignorance of what he's calling over here the ultimate perfection. That's exactly what he's saying in this paragraph that we just read towards the end, where he's saying it would be possible to do that. It would in fact be the individual seeking peace and rest of union in a motionless identity. It is possible, that is possible, but there is no necessity to uphold it as the ultimate aim of our being or as our ultimate perfection. It is an ignorance. It has not arisen at the understanding of the ultimate perfection. That difference or infinity is another appearance within which the oneness has to be experienced as the play of being, as the eternal play of being. That kind of insight is lacking in it. That's why it thinks that the suffering is just too much. Let's get out of it. Let's have a dissolution. And in fact, this idea of dissolution is not something that arose today. It is not something that arose at the time of the Buddha 2500 years ago. Sri Aurobindo points out that even the Upanishads are sort of they are kind of divided on this issue. There are two goals in the Upanishads. If you read the Upanishads, he says they are not united about the goal of life. Some of them say moksha is the goal, to get out of this cycle of rebirths is the goal. Some of them say jivan mukti is the goal. It ends up with these two goals. And so, you know, this kind of ignorance that we are talking about is a very profound thing. And ultimately, it's only when one arises at a true insight of what the cosmos is evolving towards, this truth of evolution, it's only then that the orientation towards that can take place.
So, is it? Are you saying that the initial, the sacrifice of the Purusha was with these two different possibilities? One is the full exploration of the possibility of evolving, and the other is just getting back to itself without really the full exploration.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the will is there, but along with the will, that's where the whole issue of free will is such a profound issue. It's like saying that ultimately the tapas of Purusha, which is the original fiat by which the entire creation has gone forth and which carries its own sense of its goal, where the individual has to become cosmic and ultimately know itself to be the only one there is, and not all individuals and a whole species of individuals have to arrive at that point to create a divine play. But that will happen because that is the very meaning of the cosmos. That is that. So ultimately we may say that that is the ultimate goal of things. But that goal is also being achieved through a second level of free will. And as Sri Aurobindo said to somebody who told him, can't you transform me in spite of myself? And he said, I wouldn't, because that is not what the cosmos is all about. So that is where the second level of free will comes in. If you want to disappear into the origin without actually exploring the evolution of the prakriti, then you are given the freedom to do it. And that's why the mother says there have been epochs where people have done that and actually entire civilizations have disappeared. But it will again restart. There will be a beginning again, because ultimately, you know, it's up to the individual, but the individual cannot override or overwrite the fiat of the Purusha's will that will arise in other individuals. So that's what it's all about. We can, as an entire race, extinct ourselves. Nobody is going to stop us. The divine will not come and hold our hands and say, please, please, you're going to stop my what I've set out to do. The divine will just start again. That's all. So that's what this tricky business of the so-called free will is involved at two different levels. If this was not the case, then there would actually not be any true free will. God would be playing chess with himself with a kind of a sort of a already, the game is already lost to the opponent. But here, the game is already lost, but it can take infinite amount of time because it's given to every entity to make a choice. And it's only at a certain point that the choice becomes fully capable of understanding why it's been put here.
Thank you very much.
Margaret, would you like to read next?
Sure. Or the one possible reason would be that in the power, the act of consciousness, there is not real union, and that only in the status of consciousness is there perfect, undifferentiated unity. Now, in what we may call the waking union of the individual with the divine, as opposed to a falling asleep or a concentration of the individual consciousness in an absorbed identity, there is certainly and must be a differentiation of experience. For in this active unity, the individual Purusha enlarges its active experience also as well as its static consciousness into a way of union with this self of his being and of the world being, and yet individualization remains and therefore differentiation. The Purusha is aware of all other individuals as selves of himself. He may, by a dynamic union, become aware of their mental and practical action as occurring in his universal consciousness, just as he is aware of his own mental and practical action. He may help to determine their action by subjective union with them, but still there is a practical difference. The action of the divine in himself is that with which he is particularly and directly concerned. The action of the divine in his other selves is that with which he is universally concerned, not directly, but through and by his union with them and with the divine. The individual therefore exists, though. He exceeds the little separative ego. The universal exists and is embraced by him, but it does not absorb and abolish all individual differentiation, even though by his universalizing himself, the limitation which we call the ego is overcome.
So we see that Sri Aurobindo, it gets more and more subtle and extremely profound in this point, the points that he's making. So firstly, this notion of whether in the differentiation we are losing the one, or whether it is, as it were, a different kind of realization, which is not the full realization, which in a sense cannot be the full realization because it is always moving towards its fullness, at least as it is constituted right now through a differentiation. And if you remember earlier, he has raised this possibility that maybe what it's all about is that we lose our sense of self and become the cosmic being. So if we become the full cosmic being, if we can unite with the cosmic Purusha, then it is possible for us to actually live in others. Whoever one wants to become, one can become. One can actually experience their thoughts, their feelings, and feel that there is no difference between oneself and that other being. And Sri Aurobindo is saying that that is all very fine, but still the individualization of every individual has to continue in an individual form. And the reason is that the one and only Purusha there is the only being there is in every individual. That infinite one is present in every individual in an individualized form. And therefore it is the self-multiplication of the one and the play, or the delight of the play of the self-multiplication of the one, which is the very meaning of this cosmos. And that's the reason why there is no abrogation of the individual, either in a cosmic existence or in a transcendental absolute experience. Either case is possible, and both cases are necessary. At the same time, one has not to forget that the absolute one exists in every individual. And therefore, the experience of that absolute one is what is individualizing itself. It's an individualized experience. And that individualized experience is at the same time in relation with other individualized experiences of itself. But nevertheless, there is a self-concentration that takes place in each individual. And if we remember from the previous paragraph, that is one of the very properties of Shakti or of Maya, the way by which it can actually absorb its self-absorption in each discrete individual and know itself to be the infinite that exists in that discreteness. So that makes it possible for multiple infinities to be at play with one another, which is the very meaning of this cosmos, and why this cosmos is not a return to the same. It is not that we were in full possession, there was only one, then suddenly there became many, and later there will be only one. That's not the case. There was only one, then all this, at all times it was also many, and at a certain point of time, the many will know themselves to be nothing other than the one self-multiplied in a play of delight with itself.
Devashish?
Yes, Owen.
This presence of the one Purusha in every individual multiply. It's like if you multiply one times one times one, it will always equal one. And I also recognize kind of this witness presence of itself, the Purusha witnessing itself in every manifestation of every multiplicity, in every multiplicity. That's what I'm thinking of. There's this witnessing presence of itself as well.
Yeah, no doubt. It's a witnessing presence, and also it is, you know, the Purusha, again, as we saw, the idea of the Purusha has undergone certain changes. The Purusha ultimately is not never separable from its Prakriti. In other words, the Purusha is witness, but the Purusha is also will. The Purusha is also configuration or disposition. It's a disposition of each one of us is a unique disposition of infinity. It's each one of us is an order of infinity. And that order of infinity orders itself in relation to other orders of infinity, which are different individuals and the cosmos as a whole, both in terms of space, which is relationality, and time, which is a configuration of unfoldment. How is it uniquely that each such order of infinity is unfolding itself? That is the uniqueness of each individual self, you know, experience of the one.
Yeah, I wonder if there is a term in Sanskrit or some other in Sanskrit or perhaps in English that we might be able to think of that describes this connectivity of the Purusha within everyone, because it seems to me like a giant web of light that everyone, every person, even animals, well, yes, even animals, but the Purusha within us, it's all connected by this this web. I don't know if there's a term for that. I used to think it was the Antikarana, but I've been told that I've used that term wrong. So,
Antikarana literally means inner instrument. It's the inner instrument. It's the complex in the Antakarana. In the Sankhyas, the Antakarana is, the so-called mental being, which has got, you know, sort of senses and intelligence and sense mind and the ego. That constitutes the Antakarana. In Sri Aurobindo's view, the Antakarana is a little more complex because it also includes the vital and the subtle physical, the entire physical being, etc. So the whole thing, the whole inner being is the Antakarana. Antakarana literally means the inner instrument. Okay? But what you're talking about, this idea of the web of relations, of the way in which the one self perceives as the many in play, in relation, I'll have to think about whether there must be terms. I'm sure there's terms. There's images like this, even going back to the Upanishads, there are clear images like this, but whether there is one term which captures this idea, I'll have to think about it. I don't remember something offhand. If anybody does, you're welcome to explore it at this point.
If the multiplicity of all of this play all together. I'm thinking that it could be called. It might be called.
Can you repeat that, Joanna? Owen, I think your mic is still on. Little disturbance is coming out of that. If you would turn it off. And Joanna, can you repeat that? I couldn't hear what you said last. What is the term you're talking about?
Yeah, I'm wondering if maybe the term is the supramental, because it includes all of the play and all of the possibility. It's everything.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it would be, I mean, the supramental would be in terms of the Sanskrit, which Sri Aurobindo deploys for the supramental, it is vijnana. Vijnana is kind of a, you know, jnana, it's knowledge, but it's a differentiated knowledge. It's a knowledge that unites the one and the many. So that is certainly one word which does capture that idea. But of course, it's a very, you know, it's a kind of a essential, it's a word which is like an essence. There, I'm sure there are other words as well, and one can think about that. I think even maybe we could give it some thought if nothing comes to mind. Other words, maybe by next time we can think about it.
Fractal soul oneness.
Yeah, yeah. And I think Owen was looking for a Sanskrit word. Was this idea captured in a single Sanskrit word, maybe, at some point of time? I mean, was this idea captured? This is, I think, what his question was.
Is that our homework for next time?
Yeah, could be. Within the free will of the individualizing persons, whatever you take to be your homework is your homework.
Yeah. Thank you, Devashish.
Yeah, sure.
Joanna, would you like to read next?
Okay. We're starting on, it's Now We May, is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Now we may get rid of this differentiation by plunging into the absorption of an exclusive unity. But to what end? For perfect union? But we do not forfeit that by accepting the differentiation any more than the divine forfeits his oneness by accepting it. We have the perfect union in his being and can absorb ourselves in it at any time, but we have also this other differentiated unity and can emerge into it and act freely in it at any time without losing oneness, for we have merged the ego and are absolved from the exclusive stresses of our mentality. Then for peace and rest, but we have the peace and rest by virtue of our unity with him, even as the divine possesses forever his eternal calm in the midst of his eternal action. Then for the mere joy of getting rid of all differentiation. But that differentiation has its divine purpose. It is a means of greater unity, not as in the egoistic life a means of divisions. For we enjoy by it our unity with our other selves and with God in all, which we exclude by our rejection of his multiple being. In either experience, it is the divine in the individual possessing and enjoying, in one case, the divine in his pure unity, or in the other, the divine in that and in the unity of the cosmos. It is not the absolute divine recovering after having lost his unity. Certainly, we may prefer the absorption in a pure exclusive unity or a departure into a supercosmic transcendence. But there is in the spiritual truth of the divine existence no compelling reason why we should not participate in this large possession and bliss of his universal being, which is the fulfillment of our individuality.
So So he continues with that train of thought, and as he points out, I feel the kind of really potent idea that he's bringing out here is that this differentiation has its divine purpose. It is a means of greater unity, not as in the egoistic life, a means of divisions. See, this means of greater unity. This is, I think, the key to this entire discussion, which is that the one could be, the one was one. It was immune from the forever. But the very fact that the one has self-differentiated and has absorbed itself in every one of its self-differentiations is so that it may either recover itself, as he's saying, there are two possibilities there. It may recover its own oneness in each individual. It has never lost itself. Only the individual has seemed to lose itself. Each individual existence is a self-perception of loss by the one who has never lost itself. So, is it there for the individual soul to reach back to the one from which it came? Well, what purpose does it have to the one? Why would the one do this, you know? I mean, for the individual, there would be a purpose. We would go back, we've lost our oneness, and we go back to the one. But what purpose is there for the one? It can only be a purpose for the one if it is to be a greater unity, not the unity from which it began. This is a new form of unity, a form of unity in which the self-multiplied reality of the divine can experience its own infinity as play. So it is the expression of delight. This is the reason why the whole cosmic existence and the individualization of the divine is considered to be primarily an emanation out of the Ananda principle, the bliss principle of Satchidananda. Bliss is what, you know, motivates Sat and Chit to create a cosmos in which the one may be self-multiplied and know itself as a greater unity, a new kind of unity, a self-multiplied unity.
Just one image came to me while reading this paragraph, is that, if you think of a child who has a courtyard in front of him and goes there, goes out there, plays there, and then comes back home. And another the same child with another option goes there and makes a new home in the courtyard, meaning with its own rules and with its own principles, and of course own creation. So in that way, like, the courtyard is a new home which is built, versus it remained as an just a playfield, the playground, which where it resides temporarily.
Yeah, very, very, very true, and actually a nice, apt image. In fact, you can complexify that image a little more by saying that not only does the child go out into the courtyard to play, it finds that other children have come out of other doors and entered that same courtyard. And so it plays with those beings as well. It finds that in some essence, those beings are the same as itself. And also in some essence, those beings are radically different from itself. And this is what makes the play interesting and makes this a new home, as you said. It becomes a new home of the child. It can make it a new home, because it's a new order of existence. the self-multiplication of the divine is in some way pure bliss, because it is always going to retain its infinite mystery, even though it is only the same one that is multiplied, self-multiplied and at play. And that the reason for that is that even if we had the cosmic mind in which all these beings are contained, and even if we were the transcendental who has entered into every, who has become the cosmos and every being, due to its infinity and due to its freedom, each one of these self-multiplied entities is ultimately a mystery and an unpredictable reality, an unpredictable response coming out of the infinity. And that's the reason why it is a play of delight and not a play of ultimate boredom, where just one being with a certain number of possibilities is exploring those finite possibilities with others of its kind.
Devashish?
Yes.
What struck me in this paragraph is that as the Purusha is enlarging itself within the differentiation within us in the world, and the individualization is occurring, we're not becoming what you could say is we're becoming more individuals as the Purusha is working with the prakriti of our natures and individually with us in a unique way, that we are becoming more of individuals. And this, of course, has very big political overtones for the 20th century. But what is sometimes characterized as a focus on individuality, which is going into that egoic and separative sense of the ego, is transcended here through Aurobindo's purpose, in which that you summed up by saying that the purpose of this differentiation, this individualization, this becoming more of an individual, is a greater unity, in fact. So I just found that to be noteworthy, that I'm actually seeing here kind of a larger purpose, or a larger what takes place in this yoga, is that one works with that spirit to become more of an individual, but at the same time, its whole purpose and the whole positive consequence is a greater unity.
Yes, absolutely. You're absolutely right, Owen. I may say also that when we are talking about individualization or individuation, as some people have called it, there are some other philosophers of individuation. The two very important other philosophers of individuation that come to mind have remarkable similarities with Sri Aurobindo. One of them is Jung. Jung talks about individuation. Jungian individuation also, if you look into what he's saying there, is a becoming cosmic of the individual. The individual grows into an archetype. The individual unites with an archetype. That is the individuation process. The individuation becomes universal as a result, but in a kind of a unique way. Each individual will become universal in its own way. There are some differences. The major difference is that what is the ultimate, atomic existence of the individual? Is there such a thing when one becomes universalized? Is there a way by which the individual has an existence of its own? And that question is not really answered. One of the reasons that question is not answered is that either in Jungian thought or in the thought of other Western thinkers who talk about individuation, there is no notion of reincarnation. There is no soul that moves from life to life. Now, I'm told that you know, Jung actually did, you know, have, I mean, you know, the possibility of reincarnation as part of his study of the individual, but he couldn't really accept it as a premise. And that is one of Sri Aurobindo's premises. Individuation is going on from rung to rung of the evolution as the evolution of Prakriti, but also it's going on from rung to rung of the evolution through the evolution of the Purusha as the soul, as the reincarnating soul. That is a very profound thing. That's the reason why it's a very long journey, and in that long journey, we find that the individuation process is really becoming universal by experiencing self-limitation and by experiencing in its fullness what it means to be every alternative along that path going towards fulfillment or towards integrality. The other philosopher who has talked about individuation is Gilbert Simondon. And in his case too, the whole cosmos is individuating. That is the single immanent principle within the cosmos, as the individual arises out of every possible pre-individual condition. In everything that takes its existence as something that wishes to call itself something and survive, the individuation process is at work. It's at work trying to experience itself as the cosmos, even though at the beginning it experiences itself against the cosmos. It's being erased, extincted by the cosmos at every step, and it has to struggle to hold its own. But it can only hold its own in the final analysis if it is united with the cosmos, if it cosmicizes itself. So individuation and cosmicization, which are the two terms he uses over there, are the same thing. And in each individual, the whole cosmicization process is what needs to individualize itself. The individual is the cosmos and must know itself to be that. But it cannot do that until an adequate prakriti is built up. And the adequate prakriti is built up through an evolution which goes back to the most primordial forms of the zero condition of being, of the oblivion of being, from which it aspires and creates each rung of its self-existence through reincarnation, through the soul that reincarnates from life to life up the ladder of existence.
Hmm. Thank you. I'm at Pacifica right now,
the big Jung school, right?
Yes, I am. And even though I'm reading Aurobindo quite a lot and other things, but I'm obviously studying Jung pretty extensively. But I'm looking into his views on reincarnation. I've been trying to read as much as I can on that, and from what I just, you know, what I've found so far, he was hesitant to speak on some of these things, or certainly to exercise a belief in them, because of his desire to remain empirical and to be accepted among scientists and the largely secular post-Enlightenment movement that's been going on, you know, with psychology. So, and he looked at these things, and I'm pretty sure that he wrote about karma and reincarnation in terms of the collective unconscious and in terms of just from a psychological perspective. But I'll get back to you on that and let you know if I find anything. So I appreciate that. And also, what was the name of the second philosopher you mentioned?
Simondon, Simondon, Simondon. A very important French philosopher who talks about individuation. And the cosmos for him is individuating in every individual. The whole cosmos is realizing itself in every individual, but it can only go so far because, as we said, of the limitations of the prakriti. He doesn't use the term prakriti, but he does recognize different orders of being, of existence, and these are circumscribed by their prakritic possibilities. So there he does recognize a material being, a vital being. He uses the term vital. He uses the term psychic. In fact, that's where you realize that Sri Aurobindo gets the terms like vital and psychic out of the French philosophy of that time, of the 19th/20th century.
Fascinating. I can't help but bring this up, and I think we covered some of this in earlier readings, but this process of the whole cosmos individualizing, I've always kind of thought of that because in terms of, not in these terms, in terms of Purusha and whatnot, but I thought of it in terms of while we are evolving as individuals and we, through free will, we can elect to try to accelerate that evolution consciously through the path of yoga or whatever spiritual path you're following. I always thought that the Purusha, if you will, or God, was, that's how I would characterize it before, is kind of pushing evolution along as well, kind of despite ourselves. And I think that's also the element of mercy, which is built into kind of the infinite intelligence. And it plays out in karma and reincarnation. That, of course, is a process, I think, of helping us to become individualized. But kind of looking at that, the whole cosmos is individualizing, is pushing us forward on a slow pace, everything kind of forward at a slower, slowly but surely, like the, you know, the little caboose at the end. Would you look at that in terms of the Purusha acting on the Prakriti, even though we have free will, but yet there is some type of an action, and that may also be involved in karma and reincarnation, as I said.
Owen, actually, yes, I would say that that is very possible, and that sort of element of mercy, as you've so beautifully put it, is what turns up as the idea of the avatar that returns again and again, because if we are going to begin from a ground zero and from a complete self-loss, from a self-forgetting, then, as Keka was saying, ignorance is our very ground condition. And given the free will that we have, it's the easiest thing for us to extinct ourselves. Extinct ourselves many times over, just like they say about the overkill, capacity of nuclear armaments. We are sort of seeded with overkill possibilities. We can just at a wink, we can extinct ourselves. But we don't. And it's not only because there is a guiding light within, which is there, that is the immanence of the divine, but because perhaps, as you're saying, there is a mercy from outside, which is gradually loading the dice a little bit so that we can push ahead towards, towards the goal in spite of ourselves. Yes, this is very possible. From a certain point of view, though, it's not something we can take for granted. And that's partly why both Sri Aurobindo and the mother, towards the end of their lives, kept saying that even the supramental possibility, which in some sense is inevitable, does not necessarily mean that human beings will not extinct themselves. We still may extinct ourselves. And whether it is mercy that allows us to extinct ourselves or mercy that doesn't allow to extinct ourselves is something we can never know until it happens. What is it that's really the mercy? What is it that's meant for us? Is something we can never know until it really happens. There's one of the aphorisms of Sri Aurobindo, where he says, I'd rather be, I, not for me, the path of the person when who sees somebody drowning in the waters and says to himself, there were I but for the grace of God. For me, there am I, for me to be in the feet and in the sort of condition of that person and say, there am I because of the grace of God. So what is the grace of God? Whatever happens to us is the grace of God. And we cannot sort of really know what is meant for us and what is the divine will. But yes, that said, there does seem to be, and the whole theory of avatarhood is premised on that, something which is helping us from the outside, a transcendent master of the yoga who is helping us, who is kind of changing the circumstances, if only we were willing to, you know, be guided by that.
That was fascinating, really. I mean, extraordinarily beautiful.
Thank you, Devashish.
Sure, sure. I also wanted to say a word or two about this notion of, you know, what Simon Don is saying, because, you know, he wouldn't, first, he doesn't want to say anything about reincarnation, and second, he certainly wouldn't say anything about grace, but even looking at it purely empirically, what he's saying is, you know, I'm reiterating, I just said it, but what he's saying is that even purely looked at from the viewpoint of the struggle for existence, what we find is that each individual that struggles to exist as an individual, firstly, there is a certain kind of a nature grace that is working, because even though it cannot live beyond a certain number of years, you know, there's some nature process which keeps the species alive through copies of that person. But, you know, at the same time, what he's saying is that we continue to push the boundaries of our survival, of our existence. And, you know, we may say that an interim position is the position of modern man who feels that only if I dominate nature sufficiently, I can have a perfect, you know, existence in which I can survive and even become maybe you long live beyond my imagination, even become immortal perhaps. That kind of a kind of a move, you know, move up for the domination of nature is a half step. It can never be a full step, because it still is premised on the difference between the individual and the cosmos. And the cosmos, in such a case, is going to always remain an entity that will be unknowable at bottom, because there is something in it that we can never fully predict. While, if on the other hand, our aspiration is to actually cosmicize ourselves, to become truly individual only when the totality of the cosmos lives in us, when we experience the cosmic consciousness, then we find there is security. And that would therefore be the true drift of individuation, even in the microbe. That's where it's moving towards. It's moving towards an evolution in which it'll ultimately be equal to the cosmos as a consciousness itself.
Thank you. I wanted to add one last tiny thing that, and I'm still, like I say, I'm still studying Jung, and it's quite complicated to read. Similar to Aurobindo, very, very powerful, but different as well. But very, very mind. It's that the process of individuation, one can look at it from a Jungian point of view, in terms of the universe as well, the infinite intelligence of the universe, from the basis of his concept of synchronicity. And he calls it the acausal connecting principle, because I think he called it the acausal connecting principle, because science and the instruments we have currently cannot show us the causal connection between an internal psychological state and an external event occurring. In other words, thinking about seeing, your friend walking down the street and then you run into him, which some in our Western parlance call coincidence, of course, but we would call that synchronicity. And so the more you look into synchronicity, you really do begin to see that it is the intelligence of psyche, of the collective psyche, the universe, that is helping you to move forward and to individualize. And of course, he also looks at this process through dreams and paying attention to your dreams, and through other ways as well. But I wanted to just add that concept to kind of, build on our idea of the cosmos individualizing.
I looked into that a lot. I'm very interested in, at one point, I was very interested in Jung's ideas of synchronicity. One of the things that I think was central is that he was coming from a world which was very based on the received view of science, where everything has to be proven and repeatable. Yeah. And one of his main premises is that repetition is not possible, basically, because the people involved have different intent, and that and so dismissing synchronicity as something that is not part of science or something seriously to be studied, he was discounting that idea because he actually is proving that science itself is not repeatable.
Right. Well said. But he definitely believed in a God, and I'm going to be looking into more of what he has written about the Vedas and Hinduism and yoga. But so just wanted to put that in there. I think once again that this previous concept that I had of the Antikarana, which you have explained, Devashish, but yet we're still looking for this word about the Purusha, which is within us all, in a cosmic web, and I'm likening it to what we just talked about here, some with Jung. So that's where I'm drawing the connection.
Sure. So I think we've come to 9 o'clock, and where we are in this paragraph, I think it says, but we see further that it is not solely, if you wish, somebody could read that paragraph and then we could take it up again next time. But, it could be something we keep for our, meditation over this period. Matteo, yeah. Would you like to read?
Sure. But we see farther that it's not solely and ultimately the cosmic being into which our individual being enters, but something in which both are unified. As our individualization in the world is a becoming of that self, so is the world too a becoming of the self. The world being includes always the individual being. Therefore, these two becomings, the cosmic and the individual, are always related to each other and in their practical relation mutually dependent. But we find that the individual being also comes, in the end, to include the world in its consciousness. And since this is not by an abolition of the spiritual individual, but by his coming to his full, large, and perfect self-consciousness, we must suppose that the individual always included the cosmos, and it's only the surface consciousness which by ignorance failed to possess that inclusion because of its self-limitation in ego. But when we speak of the mutual inclusion of the cosmic and the individual, the world in me, I in the world, all in me, I in all, for that is the liberated self-experience, we are evidently traveling beyond the language of the normal reason. That is because the words we have to do, that is because the words we have to use were minted by mind and given their values by the intellect bound to the conceptions of physical space and circumstance, and using for the language of a higher psychological experience figures drawn from the physical life and the experience of the senses. But the plane of consciousness to which the liberated human being arises is not dependent on the physical world, and the cosmos which we thus include and are included in is not the physical cosmos, but the harmonically manifest being of God in certain great rhythms of his conscious force and self-delight. Therefore, this mutual inclusion is spiritual and psychological. It is a translation of the two forms of the many, all and individual, into a unifying spiritual experience, a translation of the eternal unity of the one and the many. For the one is the eternal unity of the many, differentiating and undifferentiating itself in the cosmos. This means that cosmos and individual are manifestations of a transcendent self who is indivisible being, although he seems to be divided or distributed. But he is not really divided or distributed, but indivisibly present everywhere. Therefore, all is in each, and each is in all, and all is in God, and God in all. And when the liberated soul comes into union with this transcendent, it has this self-experience of itself and cosmos, which is translated psychologically into a mutual inclusion and persistent existence of both, in a divine union, which is at once a oneness and a fusion and an embrace.
Wow.
Just an incredible paragraph. Just one of those very, very complete Sri Aurobindo paragraphs. And so I think it's a very appropriate paragraph to end with and to meditate on and reconsider when we get back together, which will be on I guess 26th September, am I right?
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
Also, the reading was so beautiful.
Yes, yeah, very nicely read, Matteo. Beautifully read. Beautifully,
yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So we'll stop here and continue on the 26th.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
All right.
Thanks,
thank
David.
Thanks.
Until next time.
Okay, bye-bye.